Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with justice delayed since the 1980s until last Friday, with an 80-year sentence given to Guatemalan General Rios Montt for genocide. Cultural anthropologist Victoria Stanford, who spent the last 20 years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala, joins us to discuss the fight for justice for the Mayan people, 200,000 of whom were slaughtered by a military who, along with an entrenched oligarchy, still rule this cruel and corrupt narco state. Then we'll look into the alarming findings from the Scripps Oceanographic Institute's observatory on Hawaii's Mauna Loa that now measure CO2 in the atmosphere at 400 parts per million, the highest the Earth has seen in 3.6 million years. Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel, a climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, joins us to discuss the significance of this finding and the rapid rise of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is further evidence, as if we needed it, of global warming, climate change, and rising sea levels on an endangered planet. Then finally, we'll speak with Dr. Amitai Etzioni, who is a professor of international affairs and director of the Institute for Communitarian Studies at George Washington University. We'll discuss his latest article at The Atlantic, "The Liberal Narrative is Broken and Only Populism Can Fix It," and the fact that for every one liberal in America, there are two conservatives, and that current ideas liberals have about changing that uncomfortable political equation are delusional. And joining us now is cultural anthropologist Victoria Stanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers within Guatemala, Colombia, and South Africa. She is the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College, City University, New York, and has spent the past 20 years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victoria Stanford.
Thanks so much for having me.
And given that you've spent the past 20 years going back to the 1990s in Guatemala doing field work, and I imagine it's pretty grim and grisly field work if you're uncovering evidence of genocide, how did you react to the verdict on Friday where the former dictator, Efrem Rios Montt, was sentenced to 80 years in jail for genocide?
Well, I get goosebumps when you ask me the question, so that gives you an idea. 10 years ago, I was publishing a book in Guatemala about Rios Montt as a genocidaire, and he was running for president. So in the passage of 10 years, he's gone from being the candidate in a runoff, almost winning the presidency, to spending the weekend in jail as the first head of state ever convicted for genocide by a domestic court. It's amazing.
And what do we make, though, of the fact that the current president, retired General Otto Perez Molina, has denied that genocide ever took place? He himself may well be guilty, if not as guilty as Rios Montt, even more guilty. Does he have the power to overturn this verdict?
Absolutely not. He wishes that he did. So he's using what he does have, which is his ability to mobilize other military, retired military people and sympathizers to the military and do a disinformation campaign denying that the genocide took place. But he is a genocidaire. He was in Neiva, the area of Guatemala where Rios Montt's just been convicted of committing a genocide, and he was the commander there. And there's footage of him standing in the midst of dead bodies saying the army doesn't kill, while his soldiers are kicking the dead bodies and saying, we brought these people to be interrogated by the major being Perez Molina. He's a genocidaire. He's not going to admit what he did. The question really is, are they going to bring a sitting head of state to court charged with genocide?
And what's the politics of the country at the moment? I mean, my understanding is it's a very, very corrupt government, tremendous influence of drug cartels. It has this deeply entrenched oligarchy that's been running the place forever, represented by the business association known as CACIF. So give us a quick sketch of the political power structures there.
Well, I think that you just did. And in the midst of all that, what's amazing is that since the signing of the peace accords, a reasonably independent judiciary and functioning prosecutorial section has developed. And that's why we have this case happening there. That's why Rios Montt was convicted. There's been the beginning of a semblance of rule of law in Guatemala. That's not to say that there isn't corruption in the prosecutorial system or in the court system, which is why Rios Montt's defense lawyers have successfully been able to get other judges in different parts of the court to repeatedly stop the case, because at least 50%, it's a 50-50, who's corrupt and who's not. But there are good people, and there have been reforms. And the trial and conviction, I think, isn't just about the genocide. It's also about the peace process itself. It's about democracy in Guatemala. And the fact that he was convicted means that there is a possibility for there to be a democracy. And it means that the peace accords that were signed in 1996 are more than just the cessation of killing.
And again, I'm speaking with cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers within Guatemala, Colombia, and South Africa. She is the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College, City University, New York, and has spent the last 20 years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. Can you describe for us, obviously it's Sunday morning and we don't want to be too upset people unduly, but the truth of the matter is genocide did take place and you're one of the people that uncovered the evidence. Describe your field work if you can.
Sure. Well, the work that we began in the early 1990s in Guatemala with the Guatemalan Forensic Anthropology Foundation were the exhumations of clandestine cemeteries, which means the forensic excavation of the skeletal remains and artifacts of people who were brutally murdered by the army. And I took testimonies from survivors so that we could reconstruct what happened in these communities before, during, and after the massacres. I think that people can imagine every atrocity. Sadly, we know all kinds of awful things that happen in the world and the different and brutal ways that people can kill. But because it is Sunday morning, what I will say is in the leaked document that belonged to the Army, Operation Sophia, Plan Sophia, you can find it in the National Security Archives, they have code words for everything, for not only for their military officers, but they have a code word for Ishil women, cucarachas, cockroaches, and they have a code word for Ishil children, chocolate, chocolate. And the orders are, kill the cockroaches, leave no chocolates. We know what that means.
And this group that you're talking about, they are a Mayan tribe, is that right?
The Ishil Maya, correct. There are 21 different Maya indigenous groups, and the Ishil Maya are in northern Guatemala, and this is the area where one of the genocides took place. So it was a genocide of indigenous people throughout the country. The particular case that Rios Montt has been charged with committing genocide is against the Maya, against the Ishil Maya.
And all told, some 200,000 people were killed by the military, and I guess to some extent also by the guerrillas. So let's get some context for that then, Victoria Sanford. Why were the military killing their own people, even if there's a kind of racism involved, which I understand is the case?
Sure. I mean, there's a deep-rooted racism. I want to talk about the numbers for a minute. 200,000 people were killed, and 83% of the people killed were Maya. And of the 200,000 people killed, the 50,000 people disappeared, and all of the acts of violence in Guatemala, the Truth Commission found that the army committed 93% of those acts of violence, that the URNG guerrilla committed 3%, and they were unable to attribute 4%. So when the army says both sides committed excesses or this was an armed confrontation, that's absolutely not true. It was the wholesale slaughter of civilians. And why did they do it? It was a preemptive strike. If you think of what Central America looked like in the early 1980s, and you layer into it that Guatemala is the only majority indigenous country in the Americas, and that it has the most unequitable distribution of wealth in the hemisphere, and a higher concentration of land wealth than any other country in the hemisphere, and one of the worst in the world, you look at the fact that in the early 1980s, the guerrilla in El Salvador controlled 30% of the territory, and the Sandinistas were having a revolution in Nicaragua. what I would suggest is that the army and the oligarchy got together and they said, well, we don't want a revolution here. We're not going to let a bunch of Indians run this country. And they just decided to eliminate them. And that's why it was so easy for Rios Montt to say, we're going to take the water away from the fish. He never said, we're surgically removing the gorilla. There were no tactical operations to try to eliminate the 2,500 gorilla that were demobilized. What he did was he said, we'll take the water from the fish. And they went in and deliberately killed all civilians to make sure there were no guerrillas.
And tell us about the guerrilla group, the UNRG.
Well, when the URNG demobilized in as part of the peace accords in 1996, there were 2,500 combatants that demobilized. About 900 of them actually carried weapons. At that time, the army in Guatemala had more than 60,000 heavily armed troops. They also had more than 250,000 of the civilian male population forcibly participating in army-controlled civil patrols. And of that 250,000, they had 15,900 of those men armed. So the guerrilla were always outgunned. It wasn't a war against the guerrilla. It was a war against any type of social change, which is why the army targeted, in both rural and urban areas, teachers, students, catechists, priests, nuns, union organizers, cooperativists, anyone who spoke for social or political change. Because in Guatemala, if you speak up for political participation or for economic participation or for equality, the oligarchy and the army will label you as a subversive, as a communist, as a guerrilla, and today as a drug trafficker.
Well, I recall speaking, I think her name was Jennifer Harbury, whose husband was murdered some time ago, and the brutality of the Guatemalan military was unspeakable. I mean, it's unbelievable. That's what I don't understand, is where does that incredible brutality come from? From just the arrogance of being oligarchs? But then of course, who were the foot soldiers? Who were the executioners? They weren't the rich ones, were they?
No, they weren't. But it's a very good question, and I think that the answer lies in the fusion of this deep-rooted racism on the one hand and this incredibly brutal military training that involved killing dogs that were with your bare hands and eating raw dog meat out of a bowl. And if you vomited, you had to eat that. I mean, the brutality, they learned to torturing one another. The brutality with which soldiers were trained. I've interviewed former soldiers in Guatemala and in exile in the United States and Mexico and Caipiles. And what they'll say consistently is they taught me to hate. I hated my commanders. I hated the other soldiers. I hated myself. I hated the peasants begging for mercy. They teach people to hate. And the brutality is systematic. And so we know that people were trained to commit atrocities because it's too much that the exact same atrocities are happening all over the country at the same time. So when the army says, as Rios Montt's lawyers did, and as Perez Molina will say, you know, there were rogue officers, some people were out of control. Well, that doesn't make sense. When there are 626 massacres around the country, and they all have the same framework, the same pattern of excessive and horrible behavior, of tying people to trees and making neighbors, machete neighbors, to death. They're horrible, awful things that were done, but they're the same tactics used all around the country at the same time.
And again, I'm speaking with cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who has spent the past 20 years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. And just a brief sketch of the history, of course, there was a CIA coup in Guatemala in 1954, getting rid of a very, very harmless leader who dared take care of the country's people, installing this succession of military thugs. The American military relationship was fairly deep until in the 1970s when Jimmy Carter cut off aid to them, but then Ronald Reagan restored it. And then, of course, Rios Montt took power in a coup. President Reagan described Rios Montt as a man of great personal integrity and commitment. Rios Montt himself, who's just been sentenced to 80 years in prison for genocide, he was a right-wing Christian evangelical associated with a fundamentalist charismatic church here in Northern California, I believe. He was operating apparently with religious fervor, trying to eliminate communist atheists. That's my understanding.
Well, and Catholics. The church went after Catholics. When Rees-Mont came to power, so many clergy were attacked and murdered, in particularly in Quiché area, which is where the Ishil live, but in other parts of the country as well, that the Catholic Church withdrew its clergy and closed its churches. The army quickly took over those churches. I participated in an exhumation in a colonial church in San Andres, Sacabaja, and the army made that church, as they did in 9 other municipalities, they made these central colonial churches their jails, their torture chambers, and then they buried their victims in the floor of the church. We actually exhumed tortured people who'd been tortured and killed inside of a church. The Church of the Word, which you're right, was from Eureka, California. 2 years before Rees-Mont came to power, that church was run by a man whose last name was Durbin, and there were 13 people who belonged to that church, and he ran a car wash, and it was one of these sort of halfway houses for alcoholics. Like, that was what existed. And then somehow, 2 years later, it's a giant, well-funded church in Guatemala. I'll let you do the strategic math and figure out where all the money came from. But that church used this disinformation campaign where they claimed that anyone who raised any questions about inequality in the country were guerrilla, which meant they were communists, which meant that they were the devils. And the propaganda that they dropped actually showed people with tails and horns like the devil.
But the long and the short of it was that you only had about this so-called guerrilla threat that Gene Kirkpatrick and Ronald Reagan and the entire Reagan administration saw as the long arm of the Soviet Union meddling in America's backyard with El Salvador and Nicaragua. It was a fiction. 800 guys with guns, I imagine most of them were trying to defend their own people who were being massacred. And the real motive was to perpetuate this oligarchical control over this very wealthy country that a handful of families have controlled forever. And now you have a government that not only has enormous blood on its hands, it's also become a narco state.
Absolutely. And so the issue today, I think, with the conviction for the United States is, are we going to give weapons to Pérez Molina? Because he's asking for weapons. He's asking the Obama administration to give him weapons to arm the police and the army so that they can do joint maneuvers to control drug trafficking. At the same time, in the last 2 weeks, he's declared a state of siege in 4 different communities in Guatemala that happen to be communities where Canadian mining interests are at work, where people have been holding protests about their environmental rights because the mining is polluting the water and their environment. And he said there are drug traffickers in this region. He declared a state of siege, and that meant that people can't gather peacefully, they can't protest, and there are images of the army holding lists of names, and they're picking up those people. So I think the question for us as Americans today is, what are we going to do in Guatemala? Certainly, we shouldn't be sending weapons to this government.
Well, but is this an incredible and cynical ruse here? This is a government of generals and oligarchs who are in bed with drug dealers, and at the same time, they're using the war on drugs as a way to round up people and round up their political enemies and suppress dissent? I mean, that's pretty
cynical. That's what they did during the Cold War. They used anti-communism to do the same thing. And that's what they're doing today with using the drug traffickers. I mean, people went from being subversives and guerrillas to being drug traffickers. And they're very good at using whatever type of discourse we put out to declare who their enemy is. The first thing that happened when this trial really got going is the right wing set up a new organization called the Foundation Against Terrorism, and they put out a 20-page full-color circular in the newspaper that looks like the Los Angeles Times Sunday Magazine or the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and it's a 20-page piece called The Farce of Genocide, which says it's all communists and guerrillas. And they say, you know, the problem is these people had this strategy that began with the peace accords, and it's going to end with this trial, and they're going to take over the country. The communists are going to take over the country. They're subversives. The people who are testifying, they didn't really suffer genocide. They've been paid. They're doing it for financial gain. They're guerrillas. Right? And they're accusing women who bravely stood up and spoke about the unspeakable sexual violence to which they were subjective. One woman talked about watching her 7-year-old sister be raped to death. And these people are saying that these poor Ishil women are lying? It's absolutely stunning. But they think that discourse works. And CNN did an interview with Perez Molina, and he actually cut off the connection at one point. They lost the connection. They didn't lose it. He cut it off so he could consult with his advisors to find out what was going on. It looked like something from 1980s Guatemala, where suddenly there's no signal, right? But that's what the army does. They control communications. They control the way that the discourse takes place, because most of the major newspapers are also owned by the oligarchy. And there were ads that were run that included former President Berchet, Vice President Stein, saying that people who supported the genocide trials were betraying the peace accords, that they were traitors to the peace accords. That's incredibly powerful language, to say that because you pursue justice as a genocide survivor, that somehow that makes you a traitor to the nation. And then they put out a circular that's called Los Rostros de Infamia, the Face of Infamy. And on that, they have full-color photos of the current attorney general, an incredibly brave woman, Claudia Paz y Paz, who's helped to make these trials possible, the judges in the tribunal, the prosecutors who are trying to prosecute the case, the lawyers who represent the victims, the leaders of the victims, expert witnesses like Martha Casals from Spain, Jean Marie Simon, Kate Doyle, Pamela Yates, and others. They're all... their photos are there. It's a full-color hit list. It's absolutely amazing. And they're doing this in the 21st century in Guatemala.
Well, just in the last 30 seconds or so, Victoria, can you tell our audience what they can do and what our government should be doing about this?
Write to the State Department and President Obama and your representatives and tell them no military aid for genocidaires. Not today, not ever.
Well, Victoria Sanford, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers within Guatemala, Colombia, and South Africa. She is the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College, City University, New York, and has spent the past 20 years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the precipitous rise in CO2 in the atmosphere, the highest that the Earth has seen in 3.6 million years.
Woman on my block, she just sit there facing the hill. She say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel, who's a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's leading the Union of Concerned Scientists climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she has used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the deserts in the Southwest. Dr. Eckwurzel completed her doctorate work at Lamont Doherty Earth Observation of Columbia University and her postdoctoral research at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel.
Thank you so much.
And I take it that the findings from the Scripps Oceanographic Institute's installation on top of the Hawaiian volcano Mauna Loa, which began back in 1958 when the CO2 level was at 315 parts per million, the fact that the global CO2 level reached 400 parts per million this week, the highest in 3.6 million years. How significant is this?
It's very, very significant, in part because the research for very precise measurements happening at the top of this very pristine part of the world, in that it's Hawaii is in the very, surrounded by the vast Pacific Ocean. So when there's snatches of air samples that are taken up there, very careful, precise measurements, as you said, since the late 1950s, and to jump from 350 parts per million up to 400 parts per million is something that really is a fingerprint that human activities are altering and overloading carbon in our atmosphere, which is leading to warming up of the planet. To put that in perspective, we also have very good measurements, as you said, millions of years. And the most precise measurements over the long time are the first 800,000 years, where we saw that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere bounced around between around 180 parts per million and 280 parts per million. So back in 1958, it was already above this historic level, where we would swing through ice ages, cold periods, and warm periods. And so we have higher carbon dioxide in our atmosphere than we've had for 800,000, several million years. And the last time we had very high carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, we had very warm conditions 55 million years ago. And we know from past climate that the Earth is quite sensitive to this heat-trapping gas. So it's rising very rapidly. Only a few decades have we reached this threshold. And 400 parts per million is actually an indicator of very dangerous conditions coming ahead.
Well, one of the things that I understand happens with global warming is that it's a sort of self-reinforcing mechanism. As global warming gets worse and as more of the Arctic ice melts, less sunlight is reflected back into outer space and more of it absorbed by the dark ocean. As the permafrost melts, it releases methane, which exponentially increases. It's one of the worst of the global warming gases. The real question is, when do we sort of stop? Well, we have several problems. We have global warming denial. We have fudging the goalposts and the inability of countries in international forums to come up with a regime. My understanding is that China now creates most of the CO2 or the bulk of it, but the U.S. has created most of what's already up there. And the big powers seem to be talking past each other. What's your sense of this being a wake-up call?
I think 400 parts per million in the atmosphere, it doesn't care whether a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, a Lithuanian, an American, someone who lives in China, India, it doesn't care where the carbon dioxide or the methane comes from, which later it swirls around the atmosphere for a decade and traps a lot more heat than CO2, but then it turns into CO2. So methane becomes carbon dioxide. So ultimately, carbon dioxide doesn't care who puts it up there. It should not matter the politics on the ground. We are all on this planet together, and we all share a burden of responsibility. But some activities are worse than other activities. And the good news is that if we are fed up and frustrated with the lack of action by nations or international agreements, there is something that we can do as individuals to help slow the pace of further climate change. And if every American were to reduce our personal emissions 20%, that would be the equivalent of not needing the electricity from a third of our traditional size coal-fired power plants. So that'd be like turning off 200 of the 600 traditional coal-fired power plants.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Brenda Eckwessel, who's a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. As she is leading the Union of Concerned Scientists climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. And we're talking about the 400 part per million threshold level being reached and recorded in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on the Hawaiian volcano of Mauna Loa, where the highest levels in 3.6 million years have been recorded of CO2. And here in Los Angeles, of course, Brenda, there's a coal fire plant out in the Mojave Desert that supplies an awful lot of the electricity for Los Angeles. They have decided to phase it out, but even that's going to take about a decade. So again, you get the feeling that people are starting to recognize that this is real, and that Hurricane Sandy and the destruction and the fires and the floods, the weather people on television tend to be somewhat hysterical in it. They don't give you context. There's a difference between weather and climate, which perhaps you should explain to us.
Sure. The difference between weather and climate change really is the average state of affairs, so that in the semi-arid conditions of the southwestern part of the United States, you say you live in a semi-arid climate, or if you have the temperate conditions of a higher latitude states in the United States, you say you have a temperate climate. And so the difference is that in that temperate climate or the southwest U.S., there's certain weather patterns that happen, and the weather is something that lasts maybe 4 to 5 days. And you can have big temperature swings. And some say that climate change, that average shifting global average temperature of a degree or so, doesn't sound like much when the weather can have many, many degrees of change even just in one day. But the difference is, just as a bell curve that we remember from school and the grading curve, if you shift that average, the difference is that the tail end of the curve means that intense heat wave events that are before were very, very rare are now much more likely, and we can experience heat waves that can really put lives at risk, especially elderly or the very young. Those type of events are now possible that wouldn't have been possible before. So we have more extreme events, which are definitely linked to the warming planet. And the three that have the biggest scientific evidence are extreme heat waves, coastal flooding, and intense precipitation.
But my understanding, Brenda Ekwesel, is that obviously the rise of CO2 continues. China, of course, is pumping a lot of CO2 from its coal-fired plants. I mentioned that they're going to close the one that serves Los Angeles, but they're going to take their time doing it. Meanwhile, CO2 goes up there all the time. It's reached 400 parts per million. But if the pace of this last decade continues, carbon dioxide, according to the Scripps people who run those instruments on Mauna Loa, say that carbon dioxide will reach 450 parts per million by the year 2040. So it's continuing. We keep talking about it. It keeps going up into the atmosphere, but very little is being done.
That you bring up a very, very good point. The reason scientists are so concerned about the pace of reaching 400 parts per million, since 1958 we were 315 parts per million. That is, approaching 100 parts per million increase in carbon dioxide. Now think about going between ice ages and warm periods of the 800,000 years. That was bouncing around between 180 and 280 parts per million. That's a 100 part per million shift. In just, a few decades, we've increased the atmospheric concentration, approaching another 100 parts per million. Between 280 to 400, we're over 100 parts per million more CO2. In the past, when climate folks talk about past climates, we've seen higher CO2 levels, but let me tell you something about it. It did not happen as fast as this. This is a new regime. We've never seen such a fast increase in carbon dioxide. So in the past, when we had big rises in CO2, the ocean could keep pace. It would take several million years, and we saw the ocean life survive pretty well. Then we had another rapid rise of CO2 that happened over hundreds of thousands of years, and we saw more extinctions on the planet. But the oceans were able to keep pace. Right now, we're going so fast that we're acidifying the oceans, and there are little organisms that make shells and so on. We're seeing in cold Arctic environments, coral reefs, other behavior. We're basically eroding the base of the ocean food chain. Meanwhile, we are overfishing at the top of the food chain, and so the oceans are under crisis because of the pace of change. If we were to slow it down, it gives more time for us to adapt, as well as ecosystems. But the pace of change is what has us so alarmed.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Brenda Quessel, when do you think there'll be palpable and irrefutable evidence so that people like the Koch brothers and others and the big oil companies that fund the denial, which still has some traction, particularly in the U.S. Senate, you know, when, in other words, when you see the ocean level, literally beaches disappear, lowlands flooding, etc., when do you think that will become manifest?
What we see is that, for example, with storm surge that comes in, for example, Hurricane Sandy, it's overtopping the battery of lower Manhattan. If that exact same natural conditions happen with that storm and we're approaching lower Manhattan and parts of New Jersey over a century ago, then that would have been 8 inches on average less global average sea level rise. That amount of sea level rise is due in large part to expansion of the oceans through temperature increases from global warming, as well as accelerated melting of the ice sheets that are on land. And so we have defenses that we've built up over the last century to protect our coastal communities and the San Francisco Bay Area region. You know, the defenses were built for a pace of sea level rise that is now accelerating, that does not take that into account. And so communities have to be more resilient and make better plans and plan for even more accelerated sea level rise in the future, because right now we haven't even have the infrastructure to protect people from the climate change that's already occurred.
Well, Dr. Brenda Quessel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Brenda Quessel, who's a climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, where she leads the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool that she has used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert Southwest. Dr. Quessel completed her doctorate work at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University and postdoctorate research at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Dr. Amitai Etzioni about why the liberal narrative is broken and that only populism can fix it.
Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Amitai Etzioni, who's the University Professor and Professor of International Affairs and Director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University. He served as a senior advisor to the White House from 1979 to 1980, and in 1990, he founded the Communitarian Network, a not-for-profit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to shoring up the moral, social, and political foundations of society. Dr. Etzioni is the author of 24 books, including his most recent, My Brother's Keeper, A Memoir and a Message, From Empire to Community, A New Approach to International Relations, and How Patriotic is the Patriot Act? He has an article at The Atlantic, The Liberal Narrative is Broken and Only Populism Can Fix It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Amitai Etzioni.
I'm delighted to be back with you.
And last time we spoke, you talked about how, in effect, it's fallacious to see our political divide in our democracy, if we can use such a generous term, that the divide between the Democrats and the Republicans really is not the best way to look at American politics, that the real divide is between a conservative party and a very small liberal party. And so I take it that the article that you've written in The Atlantic, the liberal narrative is broken, and only populism can fix it. Is that that's the next stage in your argument, is it not?
Exactly right. Allow me just to take 1 second and wish Eleni Etzioni in Los Angeles happy Mother's Day, mother of my wonderful grandchildren. They are very, very much the way you say it. Before we come to the solution, we need to recognize the problem. We keep talking about Democrats and Republicans, but about a half Democrat, both in the electorate and in Congress, very often vote with the Republicans. Think about Conrad and Ben Nelson and Bacchus. And so to begin with, the deck is stacked against the liberals because they're a minority. Then liberals console themselves and say, well, you don't get it. These people are just philosophically conservative. But when you ask them about specific programs, Medicare, Social Security, they love them. All we have to do is remind people that the government gives them all these good services, the parks, the airports and such, and they will vote liberal. But it turns out people cannot vote for specific programs. They just have one vote, and about two-thirds cast them on the basis of their philosophy, which is conservative. So then we come to the question, where is the narrative? Where is a liberal rationale which can get us over, peel off some of those other people to join the liberal cause?
Well, I suppose in a way you have to go back to Williams Jennings Bryan and the first Gilded Age, and I think it's reasonable to say we're in a kind of repeat of the Gilded Age today, with the disparity of wealth and the 99% versus the 1%. But back in the first Gilded Age, when McKinley ran against William Jennings Bryan, you had real populism on the left. You had a powerful liberal movement, and it was actually tied to the Bible, if you will. You know, you had a religious left in those days, not a religious right. So, what happened to that?
Well, you got me here because I'm not very up on American history. Actually, I'm a sociologist, and I spent the last 50 years studying contemporary American society. And I just learned something from you. No, and I didn't know about the religious left, so I knew about Catholic workers and such.
Right. Well, remember, he was the guy, William Jennings Bryan, who was outspent about 200-1 by the plutocrats, and then McKinley got elected and was almost immediately shot. And then the accidental president showed up, Teddy Roosevelt, who they put on the ticket to balance the ticket, so that the plutocrats wouldn't look so greedy. That was the course of their worst nightmare. Teddy Roosevelt turned out to be a reformer. But the Williams Jennings Bryan is the same guy that did the Scopes trial, where he argued against evolution in a famous, you know, iconic trial that they made a movie out of. So I don't mean to give you a history lesson.
No, that's actually the part about Roosevelt even I knew. Yeah. But let's roll it forward to 2013. So where is the narrative which I think has a prayer, if you want to use a religious term? And I believe it's not the 99. It's not anything which starts the story with what sounds like reallocation of wealth. I believe at the moment the issue is to talk to people who are angry for very good reason, and many of them are not liberal at all. In fact, many of them support the Tea Party, and they have a strong sense that the government is not working for them, it's not responding to their needs, and very often they're right. The political science term which I think is most appropriate here is the term captured. There are many parts of the government which have been captured by very narrow special interests. If you just close your eyes and throw a dart at the news, you'll come up with a story practically every day about some part of the government which, instead of working for the people, for workers, for farmers, for consumers, is working for very special interests. And some of them are so outrageous that it makes my blood boil. So just to take, I give you as many examples as your time allows. If you are the director of a hedge fund, which to begin with does no good, to begin with is kind of an ugly form of speculation, you don't have to pay income tax like the rest of us. Your salary is treated like capital gains. Why? Because they somehow got some contribution to somebody in Congress and they've written that into the law. If you run a casino or some of those private prisons, you don't have to pay federal income tax because you declare yourself as a real estate. And the IRS approved that you don't have to, and. So when you read this day in, day out, you do not feel, you don't think about a government as the one which gives you the parks and Yosemite and ensures the traffic of the airlines and makes your drug safe. You think about it as a bunch of people who are in the pockets of special interests. That anger is misdirected because if you scratch it, people can see, and I think we can show them, that it's not the government which is at play here, but those special interests with deep pockets who are able to capture large parts of the government.
And again, I speak with Dr. Amitai Etzioni, who's a university professor and professor of international affairs and director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University. He has an article at The Atlantic, "The Liberal Narrative is Broken and Only Populism Can Fix It." So in terms of setting this context, then maybe it is time to have a national debate about the extent to which we still have a democracy, whether it is in fact an oligarchy and a corporate plutocracy that have taken over our democracy, if indeed, as is apparently the case, most of the federal government has been captured.
You're absolutely right. I think the technical term you used earlier, plutocracy, is exactly the correct one. Increasingly, instead of one person, one vote, we have $1, one vote. But it turns out that, and there's unfortunately a lot of evidence, that for some reason the American public eyes glazes over when you talk to them about campaign financing reform. They either don't believe that you can stem the flood of corporate money, or they've been convinced that as the Supreme Court ruled, that money is speech. So or in general, they're more interested in employment and jobs and substantive issues than what's called process issues. But unfortunately, that end of the story, even after Citizens United, which further opened the floodgates for corporations, it seems that's not a story we can start with. So I think we have to start showing people that it's the special interests which pervert and the government, turn it into plutocracy. I believe then they will be ready to make the next step and realize that unless you return to one person, one vote, we will not have anything resembling a democracy.
Well, is it possible, though, that we're talking about a kind of political version of the Stockholm syndrome here, where the victim identifies with the torturer, that working people in this country and people who vote Republican, and again, it's 2-1 for every liberal, there are two conservatives in America, that, you know, that there's nothing that strikes me as more cynical than the idea that these plutocrats who have stolen the country out from under us, we call them job creators.
Mm-hmm. Well, the question is, having the correct analysis now that we agree, is how to bring in this conversation to people, whether they have a Stockholm syndrome or they are bored by discussing campaign finance reforms, or they have become cynical because, for instance, President Obama promised in the last election campaign that he will introduce a constitutional amendment to prevent corporations from making unlimited donation, to correct for these things the Supreme Court the conservative Supreme Court did, but allowing unlimited donations by corporations and by rich tycoons, that he didn't take a single step in that direction. So it's very, very difficult not to become cynical when the administration makes deals with pharma, makes deals with insurance companies. Well, single payer was not even discussed. We considered a great liberal victory when we have now a program called Obamacare, which was invented by the Heritage Foundation as an antidote to the liberal agenda of a single payer. And so we really need to find a way to restore people's faith that, yes, change can happen.
So in terms of that that narrative, you know, as opposed to the broken liberal narrative, what have you come up with? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No. I think at one point the president talked about a fair society, and society in which everybody has a fair shot, everybody plays by the same rules, and I think that is a good vision. It does not start where maybe some people want to end up, where everybody has the same assets. That's not a good starting point for an American conversation. But a society which everybody gets a fair share. The word fair, I tested it, and it has a much broader appeal than the term equality. And the other side is a narrative must have the bad guy or the bad, who is the cause of the problem, not only the salvation. And the cause of the problem are narrow special interests with deep pockets. That's a conversation which Occupy Wall Street can share even with many in the Tea Party.
And you don't need to identify the bad guys? You think people know who they are?
Oh, I can give you the list. There are the corporations which pollute, there are the banks which take taxpayers' money and give bonuses to the executives. There are the people who don't put into jail, people who hire people to commit fraud. The list is clear and not at all difficult. It's daily in the papers.
So, but what do you say?
Just one detail here. Yeah. We need to, above all, to explain, it's not just rotten apples. There's something rotten in the barrel.
I get that, but one of the problems with the liberals are that they're very faint of heart, and they're very easily disappointed, as they are with Obama, and I have a lot of liberal friends, and their first instinct is to attack a fellow Democrat who's slightly to the right of them, than to attack a Republican who's a million miles to the right of them, and that seems to be a kind of pathology. And you know, how do you inspire these people to re-engage in a broken political system?
Well, you raise a very, very important issue here. So we now have this new group which the Obama people organized, and they've been going after those Democrats, conservative Democrats who voted against gun control. And they've been criticized by the Democratic Party along the line you just said. Why don't you go after Republicans and leave the Democrats alone? That's not going to work. I do believe that you can tell a liberal senator from a conservative whether it's a Democrat or Republican. And those people who attack entitlements, who want to cut Medicare and Social Security to transfer more money to Wall Street, I don't care what party they belong to. And that, if we not accept that, I don't see how we can bring real change. And let me just be clear about this last point. If anybody would say, let's collect money from the average American, the worker, poor, everybody, and send a check to Wall Street, you would say, come on, even in the United States, that doesn't happen. But when we do it in two steps, first we create a deficit that is largely caused by Wall Street. Then we pay for it by collecting taxes from the American people. That's basically the same thing, only it's done in two steps. So the situation is really very embittering, and I believe we need to use the darker language because it's a true language.
Well, you have to add to that that the deficit itself, the debt, is owned by the wealthy and it's serviced by the taxpayers.
That's true. So, you know, there are pension funds and senior citizens.
Right, exactly.
It gets a little complicated.
It does get more complicated. Well, just though, is there a connection, Dr. Amitayatsioni, between the lowering of our education standards and the collapse of public education and the rise of right-wing voters? Is it a case that not just that the Liberals don't have a narrative that's attractive and engaging most Americans, most Americans, are ill-educated?
Yeah, it's true that when people, there's very good correlation between being well-informed and having a college education and a better understanding of the American political system. But even in this area, we need a second thought. Look what happened to the attempt by Al Gore to create a progressive radio program or television show. And Air America, and now he sold it to Al Jazeera. We are not doing very well in the field of communication. And Fox is doing better. Two MSNBC is trying to catch up. But we really don't have a very strong liberal narrative and a very strong network of liberal communication tools. You're kind of like a voice in the wilderness. And we need a narrative and we need to be able to tell it.
Well, yeah, I certainly wouldn't turn to Al Gore. After all, he lost three debates to George W. Bush. The smart guy lost to the dumb guy. So I think we got to do better than Al Gore.
That's exactly. But where is that other person?
Well, I know. I mean, you can look back in history. There have been great, great left-wing populists. Will Rogers, for example, was the most popular man in America, and he was very much of the working man. Mark Twain, what a great example he is. I wish we could find somebody like him today.
I'll second that in a
heartbeat. Well, look, we've got to end it now, and I thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Amitayatsioni.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Amitayatsioni, who's the University Professor and Professor of International Affairs and Director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University. He served as a senior advisor to the White House from 1979 to 1980, and in 1990, he founded the Communitarian Network, a not-for-profit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to shoring up the moral, social, and political foundations of society. Dr. Amitayatsioni is the author of 24 books, including his most recent, My Brother's Keeper, A Memoir and a Message, From Empire to Community, A New Approach to International Relations, and How Patriotic is the Patriot Act. He has an article at The Atlantic, The Liberal Narrative is Broken and Only Populism Can Fix It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.